AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
Moncrief on News Talk.
As you know, Gaza is now all but flattened, but more than homes and hospitals and schools have been destroyed. With it has gone centuries of history, because for thousands of years, it has been a settled area, one that was highly prized by the various colonial powers. Along with Anita Anand, the historian William Dalrymple has been outlining this history in his podcast, The Empire Podcast. William, good afternoon.
How are you, Sean? Thank you for having me on.
So how old is Gaza? What are the earliest historical references to it?
Well, this has been the great excitement that we've had when researching the history of Gaza for my Empire podcast. It's so much older than I think anyone has realized. I kind of thought that it was probably a small place that was always there and then swamped by refugees at the Nakba in 1948. But the history actually turns out to be incredibly rich. The earliest references are from the time of Pharaoh Thutmose III, and I think it's 1483 BCE or some figure like that. It was always this frontier between the coast of Palestine and the coast of the Levant and whatever powers were in Egypt. It's the very last fertile area. It's got rich, contrary to our image of Gaza today, where, you know, we think of it as a sort of desert destroyed by the IDF. It's in fact very rich soil, really rich soil with very good groundwater. And the Wadi Gaza, the river, is the last major water source before the Negev and the Sinai. So it's always been a vital strategic place to hold on to, whether you're a power in the Levant heading towards Egypt or whether you're an Egyptian force wanting to invade the Levant. It's on that crucial linchpin between Asia and Africa, if you sort of pan out a bit further.
Mm.
So it's this very, very ancient and heavily contested territory where every one of the very many invaders that have come through this land have had to try and control in order to maintain hegemony over that whole coastline.
And while these various powers have had control of it, the native population in Gaza have, it's probably too strong to say, been unaffected by it, but, you know, has a life gone on in continuously?
Correct. Now, see, this is one of the really important things, because it's always been in the vested interests of Israel to deny that the Palestinians have any roots in the land or any continuity to its history. And there are many different distorted versions that try and undo that essential fact. Golda Meir famously said that there's no such thing as the Palestinians. It's one of the memes you see very frequently on social media. The Palestinians were an invention of the KGB in the 1960s. Other distortions claim the Palestinians turned up basically to build the kibbutzes and the settlements in the 1930s when the Zionist movement first started. That old lie that Palestine was a land without a people for a people without a land. And then the other version that Netanyahu tried only last week when he was with Trump was that the people in Gaza are, in his words, Arabs who arrived in the 7th century. Now, none of that is true, as we now know from studying the DNA. And the reality is that although Israelis and Palestinians both don't like this, they're cousins. They've all got roots in this land. The DNA haplop groups that you find in Bronze Age skeletons from this region are found both in modern Palestinians and in modern Jews in different degrees. The ones who have the strongest connection are, weirdly, this group, the Samaritans. You know the Good Samaritan story in the Gospel. They are still there in Nablus, the Samaritans. They're a group that emerged parallel to the Jews, with the same sort of antiquity and a different version of Judaism, in a sense, that were early declared heretical. They have got almost unchanged genetics comparable to those of the Bronze Age skeletons, which archaeologists dig up. The group that's next closest is the Palestinian Christians, the descendants of the first Christians. Many of them who are converted Jews or converted Greeks or converted Aramaeans or Canaanites who became the first Christian communities. And then next up are the kind of Mizrahi Jewish communities who have remained in the Middle East and never intermixed. And the Palestinian Muslim community who intermixed a little with peoples coming from around the region over the course of the Middle Ages, but who, again, have genetics strongly linked to the region. So thanks to the study of genetics, we can now see for sure the lie that these people are not connected to this history. The modern Palestinians, if you look at them, when you see them on the TV, you know, some of them have got blue eyes and fair hair. Some of them are very dark, looking like black Africans or Egyptians. Some of them, there's every kind of gene there. And that's because this area, you know, has been successively Canaanite. Then the Philistines turn up. Then the Greeks and the Assyrians turn up. Then the Romans, then the Crusaders, then the Ottoman Turks. And the Arabs. So there is a huge range of different peoples contained in the mixed cosmopolitan blood of the Palestinians. And, you know, what we should be thinking, of course, is that this is like anywhere else in the Mediterranean. Any of these cosmopolitan Mediterranean ports, whether it's Marseille or Alexandria or Smyrna in the old days, these are enormously mixed places where people are coming in and out. Sailors are arriving, intermarrying with local girls. And of course, it's a great mix of peoples, and the Palestinians are like that. They're not one pure race. They're not the Arabs who turned up in the great Islamic invasions in the 7th century, though there are some genes from them. They're not, the Turks from the 15th century, though there is some genetic trace of them too. They're a mixture of all these different groups, which is what you'd expect. It's exactly what happens anywhere in the world.
And interesting, because you mentioned the Arab invasion, and we have a view that there was an Arab invasion and then everyone was Muslim kind of almost overnight. That didn't necessarily happen in Gaza.
It didn't happen anywhere. And this is a very important bit of history. So the Arab invasions have relatively small Arab armies coming at a period when the Byzantine Greeks and the Persians have been fighting this sort of 20-year war. And they just walk in to the smoking ruins. The Byzantines and the Persians are exhausted. And small numbers of Arabs manage to destroy both the Byzantine and the Persian Empire and spread, you know, right out as far as the Indus in what's now modern Pakistan in one direction and as far as Gibraltar and into Islamic Spain in the other. So they're never more than a very thin warrior elite who have political control, but, are very small, thin on the ground initially. And Palestine, all the evidence seems to show, remains majority Christian as late as the Crusades, as late as the 11th century. Specifically in the case of Gaza, when the Crusaders turn up, most of the inhabitants of Gaza are still Greek Orthodox, although there's a large Muslim minority. So this idea that, again, Israeli propaganda puts out there, that these are, quotes, Arabs who arrived in the 7th century, is partially true and partially not true. These guys do have Arab blood. Some of them are indeed descended from the Arabs who arrived in the Islamic invasions, but they are a mix of all the people that preceded them too. While they slowly took on first the Arabic tongue, which seems to have been the majority tongue by about the 8th or 9th century, and slowly by about the 12th century became majority Muslim, it's completely ahistorical to imagine that we're talking about, you know, sort of a bunch of guys on camels turning up from Mecca, murdering everybody or driving out everybody who's there and imposing their rule and changing the makeup of the people. That is just make-believe history, and no serious historian of the 7th and 8th centuries would ever believe that. We have a very wonderful guy on the podcast, Peter Saris, who's the professor of late antique and Byzantine history at Cambridge. And he makes his history very clear. There's also this fascinating character called St. John of Damascus. Now, this guy, his father and grandfather were the chancellors running the economy of the early Umayyad Arab state after the Islamic conquest. He grows up with the Caliph Yazid. He plays and drinks with the young Caliph in the streets of Damascus, and eventually takes the habit and becomes a monk in the Palestinian monastery of Mar Saba, where he writes the first detailed and informed Christian book about Islam. So these guys, you know, are really important. These are the Christian Arabs and the Christian Aramaeans who precede the Muslims and who make up a significant, though often forgotten, portion of the Palestinian population. As late as 1917, when the Balfour Declaration is issued, 10% of Palestinians are Christian. And today, you know, there are many Palestinian Christians on the West Bank. The most famous at the moment, unfortunately, is the village of Taibe, which has been successively raided and attacked again and again by Israeli settlers.
Yeah.
And this weekend, there was terrible social media footage of a settler appearing and attacking Palestinian women as they harvested their olives in their olive groves. And one of these thugs has an axe and he uses it on a Palestinian woman that I saw this weekend in this Christian village, Taibe. Now, the people in Taibe are the descendants of those early Byzantine Christians who never converted.
Yeah.
And they are all over Palestine. They're in Gaza. And we often forget about them.
Yeah. And in all these successive waves of history and various powers wanting to control Gaza, is it fair to say Gaza's most of the time has flourished?
Well, like anywhere, it has history that goes up and down. But the crucial point in its early history is that one of the great sort of money spinners of antiquity was the old perfume and incense trade, which brought raw materials such as frankincense and myrrh, the two things in the Gospels that were allegedly bought by the wise men to Jesus in the table at Bethlehem. Myrrh and frankincense were major trade goods in the real world that used to be traded through the city of Petra, where the Nabataeans were, and it reached the coast of Gaza. Gaza was the port which these very valuable materials were exported out to the Roman world. And so as early as the time of Alexander the Great, some of the accounts of Alexander's soldiers record them attacking and taking the city of Gaza. And they are amazed because in the warehouses in Gaza that they capture are mountains of frankincense and myrrh. And these are things that by the time they reach Greece are, you know, arrive in tiny quantities, are incredibly expensive. And there's a story which dates from the time of Alexander the Great that as a boy, he had been told off by his tutor for throwing handfuls of incense onto an altar, onto the fire on the altar for one of the gods. And he'd been ticked off for being profligate for this very expensive stuff he was throwing in as if it was cheap, when in fact it was, you know, some of the most expensive materials that reached Macedonia. And when he captures Gaza and captures whole warehouses full of this, you know, groaning mountains of frankincense and myrrh, he sends it back to his tutor, saying, "Here, you can have as much as you like because I now own unlimited quantities of it." Huh. And so there was also the other thing, which is surprising in a sense, you know, if we associate Gaza these days with Hamas and, you know, extreme Islamic Puritanism, is the fact that Gaza in the classical period sold the most prestigious and delicious sweet wine in the Mediterranean, the most prized wine. And it was called Gaza wine was sold in a very distinctive torpedo shaped amphora, which you can see in the wonderful show called Saved Treasures from Gaza, which is on in Paris at the moment at the Institut du Monde Arabe. And these torpedo jars turn up all over the place. They turn up in as late as the 6th century in Tintagel in Cornwall. They're being bought by the Christians of Merovingian France and traded across the Mediterranean. And the other thing that perhaps surprising is that Gaza once had was famous for its erotic literary festival. There was an annual Dionysian festival that survived even into Christian times when people read erotic poetry and got incredibly drunk on the Gazan wine. And we have lots of accounts of this. This was a famous, you know, sort of thing that that likely lads would go and, like Temple Bar on a bad night in Dublin.
That's most nights. Go there and to spin forward in history a little bit, William, to the Balfour Declaration, which, you know, it supported the idea of a home to establish a homeland for Jewish people in Palestine. It also says, nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. Why didn't that happen?
Well, what's interesting is that Balfour had never been to Palestine, had no idea of who lived there. It wasn't an area that had been under British rule. It had been ruled, obviously, by the Ottoman Turks up to the First World War. And the only member of his cabinet that had been there was Lord Curzon, who opposed the Balfour Declaration because he said, it's overwhelmingly majority Muslim and Christian. Now, as early as the Peel Report, which is one of the first government commissions to look into this sort of train crash that was developing in Palestine as the Zionist immigrants poured in, escaping in their pogroms in Eastern Europe and the beginnings of Nazi persecution by the 1930s, and as the Palestinian Arabs saw more and more of their land being bought, they being thrown off the land as these new Jewish communities are created around them. The Peel Commission has a very interesting paragraph where it says it's quite clear that those who gave the Balfour Declaration had no idea that Palestine was 90% or even, I think, 95% Christian and Muslim. That the way that the phrase, existing non-Jewish populations makes it sound as if, there's a few, maybe 5 or 6% Christians and Muslims rather than the other way around. Mm. So these guys who merrily make this declaration from London without ever going to Palestine in 1917 and with no clear information about the population living already in Palestine in 1917, completely get the demography wrong. They don't understand that in order to create a Jewish homeland, you're going to have to marginalize or displace 95% of the population, which is exactly, tragically, what happened.
Yeah, there was no period during those ensuing decades where they might have realized what this situation was. The British just seemed to double down on forcing the Nakba.
It's more complicated than that, and it reflects the kind of flip flops we see from European governments to this day as information changes, as different governments come into power, as different people rise to power, you see British policy change, and as successive high commissioners change, you see that. So, for example, the first high commissioner, Herbert Samuels, is a staunch Zionist. He comes in determined to open immigration to persecuted Jews and to let them all in. Some later governors, such as Sir John Chancellor, realize the incredibly incendiary nature of what the British had done and try and put a halt to immigration and are then met by, political opposition from various lobbies in London. And Sir John Chancellor, who tries to do this, resigns. So it isn't like there's a kind of single British idea that remains constant. There are government reports that, go in both directions. And by 1939, there is a white paper which says that we must absolutely stop all this immigration because it's going to create a complete revolution and the Arab world is going to turn against us. But by then, of course, it was too late. This is done in the aftermath of the Palestinian revolt, which is something which is will be fairly familiar to Irish folk because the people who put down the Palestinian revolt, which begins 1936 and goes through to 1939, and which is looking very much to the successful resistance to the British in Ireland. The people who are brought in to deal with the Palestinians and the Palestinian uprising are the unemployed black and tans who've been out of a job since the Irish Republic got going, since the Civil War. And so in 1920-1921, you get these ex-black and tans being recruited to the Palestine police and developing the same sort of anti-insurgency methods and the same sort of enhanced interrogation techniques, i.e. torture and waterboarding and that kind of stuff, very similar to waterboarding. They have a technique of stuffing a rag in your mouth and pouring water on someone so they can't breathe. these sort of techniques, which are started in Ireland, moved to Palestine, and often the same personnel who had been busy, you know, burning down houses and terrorizing people and shooting up Ireland, do the same in Palestinian villages. These techniques and these personnel move from Ireland in early 1920s to Palestine, from there to Malaya, from there to Mau Mau in Kenya, and from there eventually via Cyprus back to Belfast at the beginning of the Troubles. So this story begins and ends in Ireland. So in a sense, it's no surprise that the Irish have been as supportive to the Palestinians as they have been, because this is, you know, part of the stuff that you guys have faced.
William Dalrymple is a historian and co-host of the Empire podcast. William, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sean.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.